So this is the third day of our January retreat here in Tampa, dealing with deconstructing the world of self. And what I'd like to focus on today is we spent several days kind of looking at self from a from more of a content. Kind of the way we experience it in our life as a voice, as a language, as a felt sense of a being, an I, a me, a my, a Fred, an Angie, a Vivian. And today I want to take a deeper look at it. Kind of presenting some formulations from the Buddhist tradition that have hopefully will give us a deeper sense of kind of what self is all about and how we got here. And again, as I said earlier, for those of you who say, but let's get on to the techniques, please understand the understanding of causation is 80% of it. If you can see clearly what is going on, and if you can clearly see what is causing whatever's going on, you will understand how to change, what needs to be changed. And then it's just a matter of changing it. But if you don't see clearly causation, and you're only going on technique, the causes can always remain. You can know that you have a congestion problem in your lungs, and you can continually be going to the doctor with respiratory symptoms, and the doctor can be continually giving you medicine, right, and treatment for that. But if the doctor never asks you whether you smoke and points out the relationship of your smoking to your respiratory problem, you may be temporarily dealing with your immediate suffering. But if you don't understand, once you understand causation, then it's a piece of cake. Oh, I need to stop smoking. Right? Well, that was easy. Then you don't have to keep going back to the doctor. In the same way, in Buddhism, this capacity to look deeply into causation is central to liberation. It is not just a intellectual analytical sidebar. You know, understanding, this is a path of wisdom, understanding, and compassion. But it is the wisdom, the understanding, the insight that has the power to liberate. This is how the Buddha liberated himself. Okay? At the Buddha's, again, and I am not a comparative religion expert, so I'll just give it very briefly. But at the Buddha's, during the Buddha's time, basically the dominant Vedic teaching was that there was something called an Atman that was at the core of a human being. And this, I mean, I think it's, and they call this the Atman, which is often referred to as self, but my understanding of what was current at the Buddha time, that the Atman was sort of like a soul, what we might call a soul, that within the human frame, the body, the mind, and all the things, there was this self that was like this entity, this formless entity that had kind of the basic core of what that person is. And that soul, because again, people believed in reincarnation, it was that soul, that self, that Atman, that reincarnated lifetime after lifetime. It was that Atman, that thing called a self or a soul that was continually reincarnating and going through this process of purification and transformation, but that this was at the this was what the self was, okay? This Atman. Now, what the Buddha discovered through his own work was this sense of a differentiated self. Well, he found two things. Because this was his really concern to understand deeply what this was. And what he found in his original spiritual, when he was in his seeking phase, and he visited the major meditation teachers of his day and became their students and studied with them, what he discovers is what they were primarily practicing were basically these kind of trance states, these levels of meditative trance, which he mastered. But he found that even though when you were in these deep meditative states of absorption, one would feel, a great feeling of oceanic bliss, vast emptiness, no self, just wonderful, disappeared in the ocean of being. But what he found out was, in modern parlance, that what this was about was it was state-specific. That when these great meditators came out of these trance absorptions, they continued to function with this sense of a differentiation, a differentiated self. And so he saw that for him, there was no ultimate resolution in these paths. Right? So he, eventually devoted himself to his own deep meditative looking into his very own mind and experience. And what he discovered experientially, this was his great enlightenment, is that there was no such thing, entity at all, called a self, a soul, an I, a me, a mine, a person, anything. As he said, the house is totally empty. There is nobody home. It only appears that there's someone home. The world of appearance he called the world of relativity, the world of conventional reality. Things appear a certain way, right? We look at each other and we appear what? To our appearance, things appear solid. Things appear permanent, right? When I look at Marilyn, I cannot see that she was, once this big, right? That is not immediately apparent to me. And that wasn't all that long ago in the space of time, and that she is actually in the process of dying and decaying right now, right? And that this Marilyn who is here now is changing infinitesimally moment to moment, and has the seeds of her complete and absolute destruction and decay within her. That is not apparent to me, but that is the truth, if I look deeply, right? So what the Buddha really clearly saw, that there is a world of conventional reality that appears solid and permanent and real and self-existent, but when you look more deeply, other truer characteristics of reality become apparent. So he did not deny this kind of conventional world the way they appeared. He just said, if you take this as what really is going on, you are participating in a fundamental misperception from which everything flows. Now, there's a lot to be said about that, but we're here talking about the self, the I. So the Buddha's teaching is what's called anatman, right? The teaching of non-self. That is the fundamental teaching in relationship to the self, that there is no such entity as the self. It may appear, it may look like, it may sound like, but upon investigation, no permanent thing as a self can be found anywhere. He went on to say it is actually a linguistic, a conceptual imputation. We're imputing that there is something there called a self, right? In the same way, we are imputing that there is something here called a flower, right? We see this, and we call it a flower, right? And we impute that there's such a thing here called a flower. It certainly appears that way. Would everybody agree? But if I just began the process of peeling off leaf by leaf, blossom by blossom, would there still be a flower here? No. Would there be anything outside of its leaves and blossoms that we would call a flower? Is there a flower that has an existence outside of the parts of the flower? So calling it a permanent flower is just a temporary mental imputation for something that actually is a non-flower. Because in truth, we could work it the other way and go, to see that flower without seeing the earth that it grew in, without seeing the seed that it came from, is also imputing that somehow this thing just appeared self-existent. It's a flower. It stands by itself. It is an independent thing, right? But that is not true either. It appears that way in the moment, but if we look deeply, we see it has no existence separate from the earth. It has no existence separate from the rain, the water, the sky. But that is not apparent to us when we look at it. It appears to be a flower. Flower is just a name, and how it appears is not how it is. Now, I talked a few days ago, kind of psychologically, developmentally, how we go from the pure, undefiled mind of a child infant, and how slowly we create this construction of a self, of a me, of a Fred. Let me give you a few sense of how traditionally Buddhism looks at this. In Buddhism, there is a formulation. Actually, we recite it every day in the Heart Sutra. What do we say, Andy, there? In the Heart Sutra about form, feeling, what's it? How does that go?
Bodhisattva Avalokita, while moving in the deep course of perfect understanding, shed light on the five skandhas.
Bingo. Right? So the Heart Sutra, which is the expression of the deepest wisdom of Buddhism, right, begins by saying that Avalokiteshvara, when in deep meditation, primary realization, saw that the five skandhas were
equally empty.
Equally empty. Yeah. And then?
And after this penetration, he overcame ill being.
Right. And because of that understanding, he was liberated from suffering. So we should pay attention. Those of us who maybe would like to have a little taste of liberation from suffering, right? How many of us have noticed that that's what's being said here? And have really diligently meditated deeply on the five skandhas. I mean, here's the template. Look deeply into the five skandhas and found them equally empty. Empty of what? Right? Empty of what? Empty of anything. Any permanence, any self-existence, any true identity. That's what they were empty of. Now, what does this mean? Let's talk a little bit about the five skandhas. The five skandhas are, we could say, the physical, mental aspects of what would be considered a human being. Okay? If we say, for most of us, we would say a human being is made up of body and mind. Right? And, I mean, let's just go through this together. Anybody disagree with me? We'd say, yeah, most human beings they have a body and they have a mind. Is there anything else that human beings have? I mean, if you see it differently, tell me. Okay. So, the body is the... Yes?
The soul?
Yeah. No, no. The Buddha... Yeah? We'll come back to you with your soul.
The breath.
The breath. Yeah, the body breathes. Yeah, the body the body breathes. That's part of the body. Breathes. We feel it breathe, the air. But part of what a human being is the body and the lungs. It breathes air. I mean, would you say that the water is? What would you say water is?
When I'm swimming? The fluid of body.
All right. So the body has its constituents. You're absolutely right. But the physical body is one aspect, and its constituents. Because again, the body. Remember, the Buddha said what? All things are empty, which means also that all things are composites. So to say, like you're referring to, we call this a body, right? But the truth is, it's really just a composite of lots of parts. Many, 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 many parts. Right? So there's really no such inherent thing called a body. The body is just a name for all these parts. There is no such thing as a body without all, it's just a convenient name for all these parts. When all these parts go together in a certain way, we call that a body, right? But if we did an autopsy and we laid out all the parts, including, you know, skinning me, you would just see lots of parts. But would there be a thing there called a body, separate from the parts? No, just parts, no body. There never was a body. All there was a bunch of parts in relationship to one another. Temporarily, it come together, right? That's all this body is. It's a bunch of temporary parts working together in a certain way, relating to each other in a certain way, all of them subject to impermanence and change. Right? And there's no such thing as a body. It looks like one, right? We look at each other and we go, oh, there's. But when we look more deeply, we can say, no, there's no such thing there really as a body. It's just a temporary collection of parts, same way this flower. You know, come back here in a week, it won't be there, right? What happened to the flower? Well, if there really was such a thing as a flower, it'd still be here. If it was such a permanent thing as a flower, wouldn't it? But there's no such permanent thing as a flower. That's why we come back in a week and we'll just see wilted petals, right? And who are the flower arrangers? Who are the flower arrangers here? Yeah, I mean, are you arranging wilted petals? Right, you try not to. But they're as much flowers as anything else. But we don't do it because, in the same way, we don't display dead bodies. Mm-hmm. We don't keep them around. Van doesn't like that idea. Why we don't, you know, why not? We only like live bodies, right? When the body dies, we go, what? Let's bury it. Let's burn it, right? It's interesting, right? This body that we've cherished for years and years and years and years and years, just spent endless amounts of money on it, right? As soon as it's finished, we go, let's bury the damn thing. Burn it up. Right? It was the center of our life for 70 years. I mean, all we cared about is the well-being of our body. As soon as we're done, what do our relatives do? So form, is the first. It's the physicality. This is a human being. We have form. We have a body. And then we have a mind. And in the mind, it is broken up into four. Now again, you read Buddhist teachings, and different people describe it in different ways. The important thing is to understand that you are categorizing something that is really one and is happening simultaneously. So you're breaking it up into four different parts. But I think, to me, a nice way of describing it is sort of like you can talk about four streams, but when they enter the river, all the water of those streams are in the river, but they're all mixed. Right. So in a certain sense, these four skandhas of the mind, or four heaps, or four attributes or aggregates of the mind, are all kind of mixed. But for the sake of kind of discriminating understanding, we separate them. Okay. So what are these aspects of what we call a human being's mind, right? That Avalokiteshvara saw were empty, right? One was, we could say, is sort of working backwards. One, we could say, is consciousness. Consciousness means that capacity that the mind has to be conscious of something, right? Our eyes can be conscious of objects, our ears can be conscious of sound, our tongue can be conscious of taste, our nose can be conscious of odors, our body can be aware of feelings and sensation. And our mind, which in Buddhism is a sixth consciousness, can be aware of thoughts, feelings, perceptions. Okay. So we have consciousness, just the capacity to be aware, to be conscious of something. Is that clear? That's a fundamental capacity necessary of the mind. Next, we have what's called there's two ways of doing it, but let's say we have contact sensation, which means is as these various consciousnesses through the eyes, the ears, the nose, the tongue, the body, and the mind. Touch an object, it has almost immediate positive, negative, or neutral response. Okay. We are either positive means we could say that we are attracted to it. There's a movement toward it. Negative means there's a movement away from it, and neutral means sort of indifferent. So that's another thing, that aspect of our mind, which is this capacity to experience sensation in every object that the mind touches in its consciousnesses. So let's just work through this slowly. Hope everybody had their coffee today or tea. So we have form, body, we have consciousness, we have sensation, feeling, contact in the sense of sensation. And then we have the last two are probably most important for what we're dealing with. One is perception. In the skandha of perception is our capacity to go beyond just seeing an object and having this positive and negative. We actually do what? We name it. We perceive it. We recognize it. Oh, woman, man, Tony, right? So flower, book, watch. The mind has this capacity to perceive things, to recognize things, right? Through the medium of kind of knowing it and using language. So we label everything. We give everything a label. And we also can elaborate. We can say tall man, short man, happy man, sad man. We can perceive things. We can have ideas about things. We can have beliefs about things. We can think things are beautiful and things are ugly, and things are good and things are bad, and things should be and things shouldn't be. Right? We have this whole endless way of perceiving and recognizing the world. Now, how did this all develop? You know, all these likes and dislikes and labels and thoughts, you know what I mean? This whole world. Remember conditioning? Remember childhood? Remember going to school? Remember learning? Right? So this whole universe of the mind that labels and perceives and thinks about and believes, you know, is all conditioned by our experiences. It is not something that comes from within. It's something that comes from without, and we just respond. Right? Our parents taught us how to label everything. Right? And they taught us, this is good, this is bad, this is right, this is wrong. You should think this way, you should think that way. You should like these kind of people, you shouldn't like those kind of people. Right? This is a good way to be, this is a bad way to be. Oh, That makes me angry. Oh, that makes me happy. That hurt me. That makes me feel bad, you know? And we just absorb it. We're children. We just absorb it. No filter. We just absorb it until it gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And we have this perceptual universe that doesn't stop. Right? From morning till night, everything we see, right, Nancy? Everything, not only we label, but we have an opinion about it. That's all part of this perception, perceptive skanda. Now, there is one more skanda, which is really the key. These two are the key. And that is what's called mental formations. Okay? This is that whole place where personality, positive, negative characteristics, memory, emotionality. This is the place of drama. Right? This is the place of drama. Because when our perceptual apparatus identifies something in a certain way, then this kind of deeper formations we have about people and things, right? So, in other words, let's say Tony and I have had a very aversive relationship, right? And I have all kinds of stuff about Tony, right? Well, all I need to do is recognize Tony, think about Tony, and right away what comes up. All this stuff, you know stuff? Right? Right? See, we think it's happening from Tony, but it's really just happening from our mental. And we have mental formations about all kinds of stuff, right? So let me, like if I said Republican, right? Which is just a label, right? Oh, he's a Republican. He's a true blue Republican, right? Now that's a perception. That's a label, you know. But we may have mental formations about Republicans, right? That immediately are in our consciousness. Same way, you may say to some people, they're a progressive, Democrat. You know, they're a Buddhist. They're a Christian. They're an event. You know what I mean? So we have endless mental formations about so many things. About ourselves. You know, I'm good. I'm bad. I'm somebody who's had a terrible life, and I've been traumatized, and I'm no good, and I'm unlovable. You know, that's all. Mental formations. I'm wonderful, I'm good, I'm better than everybody. I mean, those are all mental formations. Right? And I mean, I'm just going quickly. You know, you can read books on this. So this is a big skanda, your mental formations. Okay? So in Buddhist psychology, it is said that a human being, we are human beings, are made up of these five aggregates. Now, please notice In none of these five aggregates was there anything called an I, a me. These are just functions, mental and physical functions that are just happening. They're just in play. They're just happening. They're just arising and passing, rising, passing, causes, conditions, right? Just rising, passing. But there is nothing solid that owns them at all. They are empty of any solidity, permanence, intrinsic self-existence. Now, from the point of view of us, we have long ago imputed that all this stuff that I talked about in the five skandhas, the body, all the mental characteristics, are what? Are me. Right? Are me. That's me. But me, I, Fred, if you look in all the five skandhas, because again, if Fred exists, he has to exist where? Only two places Fred could exist. He either has to exist in the skandhas, right? Or he's some kind of super mundane or a soul or somebody outside the five skandhas who's running the whole show, right? I mean, where else would he be? Any logicians here? I mean, where else could he be? He's either got to be in, part of, or he's got to be outside running the show. I mean, is there any other place that he could be? I mean, I'm seriously, this is, when you read Abhidhamma, when you read, this is the kind of things people talk about. They meditate on. Okay? So, if Beth exists, we either got to find Beth, the I, the me, the mind, within her body-mind, or else at the best that exists outside her body, mind, like a soul or some kind of super mundane thing that's kind of running the whole show. Right? Because if I say my body, doesn't that imply that the me or the I that has a body is outside the body? If I said my body, then if I was the body, I wouldn't say my body. Right? Because I'm the body. I wouldn't say my body. My body implies that somehow I am something outside the body telling you this is my body. Right? These are my eyes. This is my mind. This is my past. Right? So we're implying that there is a Fred, right, that has things. Right? So the question in Buddhism is there really such a thing as a Fred that exists as a permanent entity over space and time? Right? You know, Fred, where did you go to school? I went to Kensington Elementary School. Right? As if this person standing here was the same person, right, who went to kindergarten and had Miss So-and-so, who I can't remember, as his teacher, right? Is that true? That there was a permanent Fred consistent over time and that stands here today before you? Right? It would have to be, right, if what I said was true. Now, from the conventional point of view, we talk this way, right? Because the conventional point of view, this, whatever it is, did go to kindergarten, right? And I have my mother here, so she can confirm. She has a memory of it. So if I forget, she could confirm that this entity that is called Fred, when he was this big, went to kindergarten. Okay? So from a conventional point of view, we do talk this way. And things do appear this way. But because the experience of life as a separate self is the cause of our suffering, this matter needs to be looked into. It's not just a philosophical, psychological a dialogue. It is the central issue. Because you, all your drama, you know what I'm talking about? All your drama is based on one thing, yourself. Try having drama without a self. All your drama is about a self. I can't believe she said that to me. I can't believe they did that. I can't believe it. I am a this. I am a that. I need this. I want that. This is not enough for me, right? Tony's self went into breakfast the other day and almost had a complete meltdown when he saw the slop that was being put out for someone as exalted as himself, right? I mean, and that was just one little incident, right? I mean, this self has many greater dramas, doesn't it, than breakfast. I mean, it is an endless drama of self and its stories. It's stories about itself. It's stories about everybody else in life. Right? Endlessly. Right? It endlessly ruminates about its past, which are just the stories that it remembers about what it, in its faulted memory, thinks happened to it. Right? It fantasizes about the future endlessly. Has no idea what's really going to happen, but endlessly thinks about it. And always in relationship to what? To itself. How can I plan what's going to happen to me? Right? And how can I make sure everything works out for me the way I want it to? Why do we get angry? Why do we get hurt? Why do we get upset? Because the self is not getting what it wants. The me, the I, the Fred. So, if Fred is real, if he's self-existent, if he's permanent over time, and if he's really something that will continue over time, then perhaps the drama has some meaning. But if there's really nothing there, you know, in Buddhism, they talk about the snake and the rope. You've probably all heard that, right? I mean, just a very simple, right? The snake and the rope, right? You come home. This is India. It's a little different than here. Snakes, homes are much more porous, and snakes are much more common. And you come in, and you see, you know, it's shadowy, it's twilight, and you see this form on the floor. And you immediately get what? Scared. Scared, terrified. You get the lamp, turn on the light, just a rope. It's a misperception. But from that misperception came fear. There's also the story in Buddhism, it's a very similar thing, where this man is invited to, he's invited to the head man's house, the top guy's in the village house, very big deal. And he goes to the man's house, and the man, he sits him down, and he offers him a cup of tea. And he looks in the tea, and he sees a little snake. Just a little one. Dilemma. This is the head man, and it's a very hierarchical society. He's offered you tea, you don't not drink it. So even though he is quite, he sees there's a snake in there, a little snake, because of social protocols, he cannot bring that out. He cannot say it. It would embarrass. It would shame the head man. So he does what anybody would do. He drinks it. Keeps down the gag reflex. Drinks it. Oh. almost immediately starts feeling queasy, but keeps it down. By the time he gets home, ill, sick, 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 takes to bed. He feels so terrible. I mean, but he thinks he's again eaten a poisonous snake. He takes to bed. He just feels like he's dying. This is the end. His poor wife, he finally tells her what happened and how, and so he's deathly ill. Doctors are called, they can't do anything for him. And somehow a word got back to the headman of what had happened, and that this guy was dying, and the cause of it was that he had drunk a snake when he had been to his house. Now the headman knew what had happened. So he sent his servant to the guy's house, and he asked him, even though he was quite ill, to please come to his house. And he sat him down in the same exact chair. And he served him a cup of tea. And the man looked down in the cup of tea, and he saw the snake again. Oh my God. Here, it's happening again. And just at that moment, where he's just like totally confused and befuddled, the head man smiles at him and points up. And on the rafter above, there is a snake. Just kind of, it lives up there. And what he was looking at was the reflection of the snake in his glass. But he believed that it really was a snake, and therefore he suffered. He didn't realize it was just the reflection in the water. He thought it was real. In the same way, all these thoughts, feelings, perceptions, memories are just reflections within our greater awareness, within our mind. They have no substance. But because we believe they are true, we act upon them and we feel. It is no different. Now, you might say, but it feels like there's somebody here, right? You know, there feels like, you know, there's, you know, there feels like, you know, that there's a, you know, I'm listening to Fred's talk, and I'm thinking about it, and I see him, right? Doesn't it feel that way to you? Doesn't it feel like there's somebody there who's seeing this and listening and thinking, and you know, you can remember going to elementary school. Yeah, I went to PS21. Yeah, right. It does seem that way, doesn't it? Right. And yet, if you look deeply, you will not find that self, that I, in any permanent self-existent way. And the meditation for looking is what will convince you that what you impute to be true is not true. You cannot find a self. No one has ever found a self in any of their five skandhas or outside them. If you look into your mind and you watch your mind, that's one of the things I asked you to do over the last 5 days. Have you found that your mind is one continuous thing? What has been your experience of your mind?
It's around.
Yeah, it's all over, right? Things come and go. Things just come and go. Thoughts come and go. Feelings come and go. There's absolutely no continuity at all in terms of content. If I said to you this I thought, this me thought, this my thought, is it continuous? No. It just appears, and then it disappears. So the idea that there's somehow a continuous self, a me, an Angie, is very readily apparent to anybody who watches their mind as being not true. If my self was permanent, if there was a permanent I, it would always be there. It's permanent. But it's not always there. It comes and it goes. And not only does it come and go, it comes and go in many different forms. Sometimes it comes and goes as, well, I'm really happy. It's a great breakfast. What a wonderful day this is today. Everything's great, right? Happy Tony. Right? Forgive me, Tony. You just happen to be sitting there. You know, next day, what? Terrible. Tony wakes up in the morning, grouchy. Grouchy Tony. Everything is bad, right? You know. Watch yourself. It is so changeable. Changeable, changeable, changeable. Right? You come to retreat, you don't know anybody, you're feeling a little awkward, left out, everybody's hugging everybody else, you're being left out. Right? You're feeling kind of miserable, and it's activating your self-esteem schemas, and, right? What's wrong with me? And, gee, I probably should have never come here. And I could just tell this is going to be a disaster. And, you know, all of a sudden somebody comes up to you. Hi! So happy you're... All of a sudden, the lights go on. I'm loved. I'm noticed. It's going to be a great retreat. What a wonderful group of people. You know, what's changed? Yeah. Unstable. Because why? Because it doesn't exist in any permanent, solid, real, self-existent way. It just exists as thoughts, perceptions, mental formations that just come and go according to causes and conditions. That's all that's happening. Now, I want to say something about meditation. In terms of, let me say something, I'll come back to this, Scott. Is there, and again, we have limited time, and please study up. There's another formulation which looks at the mind from levels of consciousness in Buddhism. It's a little different than the five skandhas, but part of it. And it sort of incorporates pretty much what I've said. But this is important, I think, another way to understand this. Because we all have this sense of personhood. I can't explain it to you. Like I'm saying, there is, even without the thought of I, and again, the thought of I is the prime mover of our emotional drama. I mean, you know, when the my thought attaches itself to a perception, watch out, right? Because then it gets serious, right? And I'm sure, and you've been doing these kind of meditations with people, you know, as soon as you attach, right? Somebody steps on, Brian's watch, tough luck, right? Somebody steps on my watch, I'm upset. I mean, Brian and I have the same watch. What's the difference? My. They did it to me. They said it to me. They didn't give it to me. It happens to me. As soon as we add me, as soon as we make ourselves the object of whatever happened. I mean, somebody couldn't even, you know, most of the time they're not even thinking about us. But we go, what? I can't believe they said that to me. Or I can't believe they didn't do that for me. I can't believe they weren't more considerate of who? Of me. Right? I mean, that person could be running around the world inconsiderate, for 40 years. Never bothered me. But now they show up in my life and dare to be what I call inconsiderate, which is just a perception. It may not have anything to do with any kind of reality, right? My perception is they were inconsiderate to me. Watch out. Battle time. Or it could be hurt. Self-pity time. I mean, all kinds of things can be triggered. But underneath that, that very active world of the I, me, my thought, as I said, there is also this kind of deeper sense of, we might call it selfhood, where we just kind of feel like, without even, that it is me who is thinking. It is me who said that. I am hearing, I am seeing, right? There's just that feeling that there is an entity that's kind of perceiving all this, right? Now, the way Buddhism explains that is this other way to look at the mind is to see it as these, as I said earlier, these six consciousnesses, right? The eyes that see, the ears that hear. This is how we know the world. This is how we know phenomena, the whole world, right? We know phenomena, we know physical phenomena through our five senses, right? We know physical phenomena because we see it, right? We hear it, we smell it, we taste it, and we kind of touch it. That's how we know the physical world. Through mind consciousness, we know mental phenomena, thoughts, feelings, perceptions, right? It's through the mind that we know that kind of phenomena. Now, the mind is an interesting consciousness because it is the only consciousness that is aware of the other consciousness. It's very important. That's why the mind is very dangerous, right? In other words, your consciousness of seeing is not aware of your consciousness of hearing. It only sees, etc. for all. But your mind, not only is it aware of its own stuff, it can generate thoughts about what you're seeing, what you're hearing, and actually that's what it's doing all the time. It is taking the information, right, that your senses are giving you, right? So when you think about you see something, and you, therefore, your eyes don't have thoughts, do they? Your eyes just see. My eyes just see. But liking that, not liking that, labeling that, that's all coming from my mind. My eyes just see. But we think that our seeing of something and our labeling something and our perceiving something and our liking something and our interpreting something is in our seeing, but it's not. It's all coming from our mind because it has this capacity to create perceptions and judgments and ideas about all the other five senses. So that in a certain way, that's why in Buddhism, the mind is the key player. That's why meditation is the primary way of transformation. Because in meditation, we are focusing on what? The mind. We are training what? The mind. Because it is that vehicle that if it is misperceiving, if it is distorting, if it is skewing, it is totally, we have a fundamental misperception of what's really going on in reality because of our mind. Now, we know, as we said earlier, that early in life, let me just say, those six consciousnesses, then there is, some schools there's eight, some schools there's nine. there's a seventh level of consciousness, which is called the Mano Vijnana. This is called the kind of self-consciousness. it's sort of like, well, so if you can imagine, you got these six, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, working up here, right? And again, it's not really this way. They're level. They're all happening together. And then you got this kind of self-consciousness, self-awareness kind of thing with self. And then under here, you have what's called your Alaya Vijnana, which is like the storehouse. This, we could say, is, all your memories, all your experiences, they're all here, right? And when they bubble up, you wonder when you're sitting, doing nothing, and endlessly stuff is coming up. Some of it's just gonna, but some of it's coming from pasty or dreams or that's all just bubbling up from your Alaya Vijnana. It's your storehouse consciousness. It's always bubbling. Okay. Now under that is what's called your ground consciousness. Again, I kind of talked about it yesterday or the day before in terms of a child's consciousness, that totally unconditioned, undifferentiated, pure awareness. That's the ground of our minds. It doesn't discriminate anything. It's just totally aware. And it is pristine. It is pure. It has no coloration. It just is present in a totally unconditioned, undifferentiated, totally clear, totally luminous way to everything. It is not conditioned, divided up at all. It is the ground of our mind. It is our true mind. It is our Buddha mind. Okay? But it has, have you noticed we've been alive, right? And this mind, this pure, pristine mind, has gotten conditioned by what? By experience. And one of the prime experiences that we've gone through is this experience of labeling, right? And one of the biggest labels that we ever got was, your name is Beth, my name is Fred, that's your body, this is Fred's body, this is his book, you can't have it. Okay? You want it? You can't have it. It's my book. Beth is smart. I'll go out and get my own book. Show him. I'll get a better book. And it's off. It's off. The drama has begun. Because of this labeling. And then now in the world, it's all my stuff and your stuff and her stuff. And I want this and I don't want that. The problem, do you wonder why yourself never leaves you alone? Do you wonder why it is always giving you the message that you need more and that whatever's going on, whether it's the present moment, whether it's the present relationship, whether it's the present job, whether it's the present dinner, it'll always running around and the message it's giving you is what? This is not enough. It's this pervasive dissatisfaction. And it's always endlessly throwing up ideas to tell you about what you can do to make things better. And therefore, being a self-improvement guru is a very profitable enterprise. Advertising, marketing. Very profitable enterprises, right? Because this human mind is always dissatisfied and always looking for something to make it feel good. And getting is a big part of that. Now, why is the self involving us in this endless drama? Because it doesn't exist. Because it's not real. And it only feels real when it's in the drama. Then it feels real. Then I feel solid. I feel like me. Right? I'm a me. I got some drama. And it's opposed to you. Right? And if I can get this and get that and make this happen and that happen, you know, it's endlessly trying to reify itself through experience so it can prove I'm real. Because it's not real. It doesn't exist. The only way it exists by constantly bringing attention to itself. Then it feels momentarily real. But even then, it only lasts for a short time and we feel unhappy again, dissatisfied again, lonely again. It's always trying to create, people saying, oh, I don't want to give up myself. It seems so groundless. You know, we often say that it's scary. And that's right. The self, the drama of self is our ground. That seems real to us, right? Don't take away my story of who I am, right? Don't take away my job. Don't take away my label. That's terrifying to me. The self is terrified because it exists in labels. It exists in stories. I'm such and such a person. I mean, we can have an idea that we're the most rotten, unlovable, unworthy person in the world, and we'll cling to it for decades because it's at least it's something. It's a story. That I can keep telling to myself. In every situation I come into, I see that situation and I live through that situation through that same miserable story that feels solid and real to me. It's just a story. It disappears. You look for it, it's gone. But yet it'll come up every new situation. Nobody's noticing me. I'm just not worthy. I mean, do we really know why no one's noticing us? Maybe they're busy. And by the way, don't people have a right not to notice us? Right? I'm here. Everybody notice me. Fred's arrived. Don't I have all your attention? That's the self, right? I'm here at retreat. Come on, everybody. Give me hugs. Does our body need hugs? Right? Think about it. You know, what needs hugs? Does your body asking for a hug? No, your body knows nothing about hugs. What is it that wants a hug? I mean, I'm not talking bad about hugs, but I mean, we need to look deeply at this stuff, especially if it causes us suffering and causes us to act out. Who wants a hug? Me. What is this me that needs a hug? Right? If it's a mental thing, and I, why does a physical hug make it feel good? There's absolutely no rational explanation other than the mind interprets the hug as what? What? Validation that what? That I exist and that somebody cares about me. And that poor, miserable self needs that. Why does it need it? Because deep down inside, it doesn't feel like it really exists. It's because it doesn't exist. So it's endlessly seeking confirmation. So coming back to our model of the nine conscious levels of consciousness, you see that actually what's going on is you have all this activity going on with your senses and your thoughts and your perceptions. And then you have your storehouse consciousness with all your memories and experiences, right? And there's a lot of just moving going about. And it's all going up and down through that sixth level, that sense of all this is happening to me. But it's not true. It's just happening. For example, I'm going to give a confession. I have no idea what I'm saying. The words are just coming out. There's no I here. It's just happening. I don't even know why I'm saying this right now. Isn't that amazing? And yet, somehow it's okay, isn't it? But we believe that we got to have an I firmly entrenched, observing, watching, evaluating my performance, right? It's a superimposition. It makes life unlivable. Meditation. When you are practicing mindfulness, remember the skandhas, right? When you are practicing mindfulness, and you are doing what's called just bare attention, you're not labeling, you're just present. You are then living in what? What? Which are your consciousnesses? I'm talking about the five skandhas. What?
Consciousness.
Yeah, consciousness. You're just being conscious, right? You're just seeing, you're just smelling, you're just tasting, right? You're just aware. So in that sense, you're trying to, through your mindfulness practice and your concentration, you're trying to, remove your attention from the activity of those other skandhas, and you're just really present to your body, which has your senses, and the consciousnesses, right? That's what you're doing when you're practicing, we could say, pure mindfulness, right? Now, sometimes, there are some mindfulness practices where you label, right? Walking, right? Breathing, tasting. Right? So you're just doing very minor work of labeling in your perception aggregate, right? But it's not very elaborated. You just... Okay. Now, this is important. For those of you who have studied and read and done loving kindness meditations and all kinds of meditations, and why you still have a lot of your same issues. Okay? Remember the perception aggregate. It is involved with what?
Labeling
thoughts, perceptions, ideas, right? So in that perception aggregate, we are going, may all beings be happy. May all beings be free of suffering. May all beings know the equality of all dharmas. Right? We're saying all these wonderful, we're having all these wonderful thoughts. In other traditions, we're practicing affirmations. Right? May I get rich. May I get rich. May life give me all the bounty that I deserve. Right? There are people who do these kinds of things. Affirmations. That's all taking place in the perceptual aggregate. The problem, my friends, is the drama is in your mental formations aggregate. That's where the drama is. And if you're not attending to the drama, and the self, and the stories. You can be doing all this beautiful work, all this spiritual work, changing your thoughts, which is good stuff. I mean, I'm not putting it down. better have good thoughts and bad thoughts. But if you wonder why the fundamental suffering continues, and the fundamental egocentric way of living in your mind continues, it's because we got to get into the mental formations. We got to get into the deep stuff. And so that's quick. I just want to let you know that's why often people get frustrated, because they do a lot of this good perceptual work, but they wonder why still at a deeper level they still are suffering from these deeply ingrained, because that's this other skanda. And if we're not attending to that in a deep way, and really doing the healing and transformation work there, that stuff still stays activated. Whew. That's the quick and dirty. So as you can see, the study of self is the key study in Buddhism. That is why Zen Master Dogen said, to study Buddhism is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self, because you can see in this whole talk today, it ends up with, there's no self. There's lots of phenomena, lots of stuff, but there's no entity, permanent entity called Fred, that is running the show. It's just happening. Now again, through practice, through awareness, one can begin to redirect the show, heal, transform the show, see the show for what it is through insight. So it's not as if, you know, it's fixed. It is not fixed. It is because it is impermanent. Because there is no permanent structures, no permanent things, no permanent Fred, no permanent identity, no permanent beliefs. Because it all is just totally in fluctuation and impermanent, it is because of that that change is easily possible. If Fred was a fixed entity, right, then he would always be the same and would not have the capacity of changing. He would be the same person he was in kindergarten, as he was in high school, as he is now, if he was fixed and permanent. But if Fred is simply just an endless unfolding of causes and conditions, endless variables, impossible to know, all of them, then it's a much more interesting process. Now, the first thing, if I kind of really bought what is being said here, I would definitely change my relationship to the perceptive aspect of my mind, which is constantly throwing up thoughts, and I would certainly change my relationship to what's coming up from the world of mental formation. And see it very differently. They're just thoughts. It's just an I thought. It's just a me thought. It's just a my thought. It doesn't have any basis in reality. Is this my book? Did I make this book? Did I make the trees? Did I make the air? Did I make the print? I mean, yeah, you know, I handed in a piece of paper somewhere, and somebody gave me this book. If I gave it to Beth, it would be Beth's book. Beth gave it to Fran. Now it's Fran's book. These labels, it's mine. They're just temporary. They're about temporary relationship. And things are impermanent. Right? This book is not anything permanent. Somebody could steal it, I could lose it. Thrown out by mistake. If I really thought it was mine, and my ego had invested in it, right, then I would be what? Devastated with the loss of my book. It's all made up. Nothing is mine. Everything we have in this life that we call mine, including our body, every relationship, every person, everything, every object, all of it is the same, impermanent, in transition, coming and going. And that's just the way it is. To call anything mine is just a temporary way of explaining relationship. It's not real. Right? If that was Marilyn, if that was Marilyn's body, Marilyn would say, I want this body to stay around forever and always be healthy. Right? Okay. Can you do that?
No.
No. Because it's not your body, is it? But it is, in a certain way, we could say, you have the temporary care of this body. So you can certainly, you know, try to do things that'll benefit it and won't harm it. But that's all you can do. You have no idea what's going on inside it. It has a life of its own. And even that life it has is just temporary. And that's the truth. It's neither bad nor good. Yes.
How do we live outside of retreat and monastery in a world where mostly people aren't aware of their consciousness and mind, this notion of no self?
You live with it at ease and at peace because you understand the truth of what you just said. I live in a world where most people are running on totally different agendas. And so therefore they do what they do. Right? They think primarily of themselves, their own needs, their own wants. Some it's mild, some is, they have a big bad dose of it. Right? And it can get much worse as people get into their egocentricity and their indifference to others. And And so, you know, if you think about the bodhisattva, I mean, the bodhisattva is so sophisticated, it answers that question. You know, there's your answer. You know the bodhisattva ideal. It says what? It says, you only have two jobs in this world. Inga. One job is your own personal transformation and awakening, which you have some control over, and a relationship to the world, this broken world, this world where people are ignorant, etc., etc. You know, you do your best to help. You do your best to heal. That's how you relate to it. And don't be down because people act the way they do. They can't help it. You know, if you were a kindergarten teacher, would you be endlessly frustrated because these kids are such idiots? I mean, they're stupid. They can't read. You can't even have a coherent conversation. They're magical thinking all the time. They can't even tell what's real. You know what I mean, right? They get upset about the stupidest little things. They cry. Bunch of babies. I mean, is that the way you would think if you were a kindergarten teacher? Why not think?
Because it would be incorrect.
Yeah, because you would understand, unless you were just coming from your own mindset of how things should be, you would understand, this is the way they are. Of course they act this way. If you went to your principal and complained about, you know, these kindergartens are such big babies, your teacher would go, yeah, but they are big babies. I mean, why are you so bent out of shape about that? Maybe you shouldn't be a kindergarten teacher. Right? See, you're the problem. The world's not the problem. They're just doing what they're doing. They can't help themselves. And you need to understand deeply that that's true. You know? And so, therefore, you know, as a kindergarten teacher, you can go to work every day happy. Right? Yeah. You know? I'm dealing with a bunch of big babies, and I'm trying to shape them up a little bit and have a good time while we're doing it. And that's all. That's all you're doing in this life. Don't be fooled. Just a bunch of big babies out here. They can't help themselves. And, you know, what do they say? If you're not part of the problem,
you are the problem.
What?
If you're not part of the problem,
be the solution. Solution. Right, yeah. It's sort of like that, you know, in modern jingo, lingo. Right? Yeah, I mean, you know, you're going to be part of the problem or you can be part of the solution. You know, this Dharma, other types of practices, you know, that's the solution. And we want to be part of that. You know. Yes.
in dealing with people in our lives that we want to help.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you talked about reifying the self, which obviously I understand that that's caused me greater suffering, but mm-hmm. and I want people to help me point out when that's happening mm-hmm. and get me beyond that. Mm-hmm. I signed up for it. And the people that I encounter throughout my life on a daily basis, most of them, you know,
are not seeking your feedback.
but they are perhaps seeking reifying their self,
mm-hmm.
hugs or
yeah.
or things like that. And how do you balance, you know, how do you not enable
them? Well, next time, you know, somebody you care about asks you for a hug, I would give them a very, you know, clear Dharma talk.
Obviously, like a hug. But you know,
if you want to create some drama, you go ahead and do that.
But you know what I mean? It can go beyond that, where people, if you don't do...
You know, that is why in the realm of compassion, appropriateness and skillfulness are the two operating principles. It's not about me. You know, if it's like, I think I have the wisdom, I get the truth, and I'm going to go out there and straighten everybody out, right? Right? Now I'm like going to stop reifying my own ego. I'm going to go out there and reify everybody else's, stop reifying everybody else's ego, which is just a big ego trip for myself. Okay. So in our encounter with the world, our actions have to be appropriate and skillful. Appropriate means they are appropriate to the person, the situation where they're at. Right? So in other words, Inga, who's now our kindergarten teacher, even though she loves English literature, is not teaching her kindergarten children English literature. That would be inappropriate. Right? She wouldn't be a good teacher. Right? Inga has to understand developmentally, cognitively, emotionally, socially, where her little 5 and 6 year olds are at. And whatever she does with them has to be appropriate to their level of development. That's called appropriateness. The other thing is skillfulness. She can be appropriate, but then her technique, her skills, her use of anecdote, or her materials, skillful. She's got to be a skillful teacher. So, what you know, how she's actually intervening actually works. Skillful. So those are the two, you know, we are moved to remediate suffering by compassion, but compassion in Buddhism has to have appropriateness and skillfulness. And I think what you're talking about is, you know, neither appropriate nor skillful if the person, you know, is not there. If the person is, I was in the kitchen, a lot of times I go in first to see if they're ready. And the cook, what's her name? Jessica, came out to me. And she said, I've had a terrible day. I need a hug. So I hugged her. I didn't give her the Dharma talk about, you know, who is the Jessica who thinks she, you know. You know, that would not have been appropriate or skillful, would it? Because in that moment, she was suffering. I have no idea what she was suffering. She said she's had a rough day, right? And so you respond, you know. You know, I mean, if I knew Jessica well, and after a number of years of this, you know, I might say to her, do you ever wonder why it is you're so needy for hugs? You know, I mean, maybe, do you want to talk about that? I mean, there's nothing wrong with hugs, but maybe there's something going on in your life with... Because I notice every time I see you, you tell me how stressed out you are and you need a hug. You know, it's sort of like the, you know, asking the person with respiratory illness, do you ever want to talk about the fact that you smoke 2 packs a day and that maybe have a relationship to your... If the person says absolutely not, then why talk to them? They're closed. That's being skillful. Yeah. Yes. I mean, we all, it's very 12, but go on.
Yeah, it's been a wonderful Dharma talk, Fred, and I thank you because it's such a deep teaching, and it is helping us see the truth of reality, but I would like to speak up for the self as a useful fiction. As you talk about it, in the developmental model of Buddhism, just as you say, we're at this retreat. If I could get rid of myself, I know that if I didn't have an I, me, or mine, all my afflictive emotions would go away. They would just dissolve into thin air.
Right, but again, please understand, in the conventional world, there are conventional selves, and we talk this way, and we talk, right? I mean, why have I come to a retreat? Because we talk this way, because I want to better myself, I want to improve myself, I want to transform myself, I want to heal myself. So, in terms of language, which is all self is, it's a convention, it's a conventional way that we can talk to each other, kind of about this.
Yeah, I'm at the level where I just want to replace myself with a better self.
Right. Well, again, it's this is important. We are not here to do any of that. We are here to understand. When we understand, everything falls into place. This is why Buddhism puts such stress on deep looking and understanding, right? When you understand, Alex, that it's not a snake, it's a rope, that's what you got to do. Once you do that, the fear just disappears. You don't have to do any more work. Right? When you think it's all me in the world and everybody else is a you and you're all objects and this and that, then you got to work at being compassionate. Then you got to work at being loving kindness. Then you got to work at being less selfish. It's work. Because your view is, I'm me, I'm the central character in this thing, and everybody else is out here just to meet my needs, right? But when you actually see that there's no self at all, and then actually everybody is connected and one and all this stuff, then the compassion, the caring, it just happens. You don't have to work at it anymore. Or if you do have to work at it, you work at it in a much lighter way. So it's understanding. I mean, that's why people come into my interview room and say, thoughts, they're just thoughts. I said, thoughts, what's your problem? Thoughts are just thoughts. They come and go. They have no substance. Flowers of air. See them for what they are. If you think your thoughts aren't the problem, you believe they're real and solid. That's the problem. Thoughts are just thoughts. I mean, are trees the problem? I want a clear view. Cut down all those damn trees. Trees aren't the problem. I'm the problem. Because I think there should be a world without trees. Right? I'm causing my own suffering. Yes.
So, we just had three questions about how we are out there.
Mm-hmm. No, I want to correct that. There's no out there. What we do here, we do everywhere. Right? I am no different here than anywhere, right? What am I doing here? What are you doing here? I mean, what are you doing here?
Being myself.
Well, you learn to be yourself. You learn to be mindful, to be present, to be open, to be, right? I mean, hopefully, we're doing that everywhere. I mean, the only thing we could say here is that we are devoting more time, and we set a specific situation to be more able to do what we want. But let me get this straight. Everything we're doing here, we want to be doing always. If you see this as like a little break from real life, you're in big trouble. It's not gonna cross over. But when you realize, no, I am learning to live in awakened way, with mindfulness, with insight, with deep looking, with openness, moment to moment, no matter where I am. Whether I'm at retreat, whether I'm in Publix, whether I'm dealing with Dharma people or non-Dharma people, it's all the same.
My question is, what do we call this thing, if not myself? And who, what do we call this person that just gave us a Dharma talk?
Now, I want you to pay close attention. Are you paying close attention? Your name is Ned. My name is Fred. Hi, Ned. And you say?
Hi, Fred.
Hi, Fred. That's all. Yeah, this is it. No elaboration. No need to judge, to think, to evaluate about what Ned is or isn't. Yeah, and it's in the conventional world, that is called Ned, and this is called Fred.
Sure.
But Ned needs to know that there really is no such thing as a Ned. It's just a convenient imputation, a name, a label for that. Right? Because that is so complex. If you watch your mind, you see he has so many facets, so many contradicting thoughts, feelings, perceptions, memories, that there's no solid thing there at all called Ned. And if I think Ned is like this, if I think Ned is like that, I'm just making that up. So rather than keep making it up, I just let it all go. And I deal with Ned just like this. However Ned presents himself. He presents himself as a happy Ned, let's be happy together. He presents himself as a sad Ned, how can I help you? Right? That's all. It's all happening right now. It's all in the present. And we need to encounter ourselves in a living way. Not with perceptions and conceptions and memories, just very open and present. And you do that with everyone. From the moment you wake up to the moment you go to bed. That's freedom. That's ease. That's easy. The way we do it is hard. Everybody comes in and says, wow, that's so hard. So where have you been? Look at your life. That's hard. Keeping the fiction of self alive and all the drama, that's hard. That's a difficult life. This is easy. Yes.
You just described authentic, thank you.
Yes, I mean, we, yes.
To the extent that there is, so there's no self, you have no self, I have no self. We have no self.
No, there's no permanent, fixed, self-existent entity called Fred.
Right.
There's just this. And this is just made up of all kinds of things.
Is there a way in which the this of you is different from the this of me?
Of course.
So if
You're Rebecca.
So
right? Rebecca, look. Would you say, we call these all flowers, don't we? But would you say, from the point of view of discrimination, right? Would you say that there is a difference in how the, in the characteristics of these flowers? You would say what?
They're different?
Yeah, I mean, in the world of discrimination, in the world of characteristics, we might say that this flower appears differently than that flower, right?
Right.
Yeah, that's all. But it's made up of its own constituent parts. But because of the causes and conditions and the seeds, right, the original seeds and that, it develops differently, right? You were different seeds, and then how your seeds were conditioned by all your experiences, so you've grown a certain way, right? There are certain things that are fixed, the kind of morphic body you had, the fact that you're a woman. You know what I mean? There are certain kind of characteristics that we wouldn't traditionally have said were kind of fixed, you know what I'm saying? But there are other, your ethnic, you know what I mean? But then there are many more that are just openly open-ended. All kinds of variables in you. That's what we say. I mean, you know, this body is not your body. You're new to retreat. That's one of my standard lines. You know, this is, you know, when you look in the mirror, you're looking at your mother and father, your ancestors. They gave you your body. This is not your body, is it? Did you make it? Did you decide exactly how it was going to look? No. This is not our... We look in the mirror, we see our ancestors. That's what we're looking at. We think we're looking at ourselves. Right? And many of us look and go, I deserve a different kind of body. Right? How'd I end up with this body? Somebody like me should be looking like this or that. It's crazy. Our bodies were given to us by our ancestors. Right? And met many of our characteristics. The way we look at things and understand, even the words we say are just products of experience and people. And, you know, who knows? That's why we want to find where in all of these endless conditioned variables is there some sense of my own deep authenticity as a being. Right? It's in there. Yes. And then that's it, because it's actually after dinner.
So, if Catherine doesn't exist, if Fred doesn't...
Catherine exists in a conventional way, right? In other words, in the world... Catherine, have you ever seen a rainbow? Okay. And when you look at a rainbow, you say what?
Nothing.
Or, well, you might say, hey, look at the rainbow. Or, right? There's a rainbow. But if you went looking for that rainbow, what would you find? Right. It appears... To our eyes, it appears to be a thing, a rainbow, something solid. But the truth is, when we get closer, it's very clear that there's nothing there of any solidity. Just temporarily, water, conditions, clouds, sunlight, you know, condensation, all came together to produce this temporary illusion of a thing called a... But when we go looking for it, it cannot be found. That's what it is. That's what you are. That's what I am. Temporarily, a lot of causes and conditions have come together, endless variables have come together that appears to be something. But when you look deeply, right, when you autopsy Fred, you know, if we have a couple of physicians here, if I'd say, you know, can you guys do an autopsy? They would lay me out and all you would see was parts. And you'd go, what happened to Fred? I see all his parts, but where's that thing called? If there was such a thing as Fred, you'd see him somewhere, wouldn't you? If he really exists. But you don't see anything. Yes.
So if we are all suffering, or I'm suffering, or we're here, we're talking about suffering, are we really here just to be compassionate to others? Are we here to be a bodhisattva? Or should we just cut through the suffering and drink the purple Kool-Aid and get it over with? I'm trying to see what's it all about. I mean, you know, what am I supposed to be doing? Just being compassionate?
Well, again, if you are totally concerned about yourself and totally encapsulated in the world of self, and if you're only concerned with your own suffering and ending it, then all of a sudden things like drug addiction, compulsive consuming, all these kinds of things that we do, and then on the other side, suicide, could be reasonable choices, right? Because all I am concerned about is the immediacy of ending my suffering, right? So from that point of view, and if you look around the world, right, you see a lot of people. Those are the kind of choices they make to end their suffering. But if one has looked more deeply and has realized it's not only you who's suffering, Catherine. Your husband is suffering. Your parents suffer. The people you know suffer, right? You are perhaps moved to realize that this is a common experience, right? And so then you then look at the situation a little differently. It's not just only about me. It's really the human condition. And yet, at the same time, there are people going around telling you it doesn't have to be this way. Right? There is a ground to our consciousness, which is undifferentiated, pristine, pure, the source of all goodness, all joy, all happiness, of ease, and it is accessible to everyone. Okay? So Catherine then goes, how wonderful. Now that's something I could get behind in my life. Right? I mean, improving my golf game used to be my primary goal in life, but, you know, now maybe this one is a little more meaningful. And then once I realize that, to be able to share that with people, to help other people free themselves from their own self-created suffering, that's a worthwhile way to spend one's life. So that's... But if you are, you know, totally alone in your selfhood and in your suffering, addiction, compulsivity, you know, all the kinds of things that people do to keep themselves distracted, busy, temporarily happy, or ultimately suicide because ultimately that stuff doesn't really work. Yeah, it becomes, you know, it's because, again, those are the choices of somebody totally lost in self who don't see anything outside of it. So we need to go on. Okay.
Just one more thought. I know this is another talk, but reincarnation is like, okay, so then you die and it sucks and then it's all over and then you start over next time.
Well, again, you please understand that traditionally in Buddhism, it really wasn't in Buddhism. I mean, it was in the culture of the Vedic culture that everybody believed in rebirth or reincarnation. So that was just accepted. So there was this added thing that somehow suicide or whatever or short-term pleasures, were not the answer because, it continues on, right? So it's a very different way of looking at things than short-term. And that makes it workable, it's a little, I think it's a little more subtle than heaven and hell. But heaven and hell is sort of the same thing, isn't it? At least you think, it's not just about here. You know, there are consequences that will carry on. And if I do good, then I'll get up there and, be with the angels and, et cetera. And if I do bad, it's going to be, fire and brimstone. So, yeah. So, I mean, that, that's another whole part that we don't.
That's another whole part, but but get into that.
Yeah. Anyhow, we need
about the Dalai Lama.
We need to stop. So thank you.